trying to solve a root cause. And maybe that's a picture of a tree with a bunch of roots. And at the top is all the things that you see as pain points. What's the underlying things down in the roots? You know, picture of a pizza with different slices missing, or a test tube with different levels of liquid in it, and a thermometer with a heat check. Like, there's a million things that are all kind of the same variation of parts of a whole. I'm not looking at this as art. In the team environment, I'm looking at it as a productivity tool.
Hello, and welcome to Tech for Finance, where we help finance pros stay ahead of the game, develop their skills, and free up time for the things that matter most using technology. Please like and subscribe. Hey, everyone. So today we have the pleasure of introducing Mike Manilak, accounting manager at Google, also runs Mike from Accounting. He's written a book, No Flux Given, and we'll tell you how to hook up with him a bit later on. It's just that it's mikefromaccounting.com, isn't it? But really, really pleased to have you on the show, Mike. We've been speaking for quite a while, haven't we? It's taken us a while to have this conversation, so it's good to finally have you on.
Yeah, for sure. It's good to be on, Adam, and I know you've had a lot of cool guests on in the past, so hopefully this is another one in the portfolio of podcasts, but you've had some really interesting topics, so I'm sure we're going to get into some good stuff too. So hopefully your audience, some of it resonates with your audience.
Yeah, absolutely. And Mike and I, we have caught up before this, and we had the conversation that we normally, you know, have, which is the how much do you want me to talk about tech? And it's fine, you know, we can talk a little bit about tech, but I think it's important sometimes that, you know, we broaden our horizons a little bit and think a little bit differently. So having interesting guests like you to challenge us to maybe think a little bit differently, I think is a good move every now and then. So, really appreciate you coming on. So I want to start with one of your passions, which is drawing, right? So if you go to the website, you'll see, but they're amazing. So the way that you describe it is you can bring an idea to life in minutes, no AI required, right?
Yeah.
And if you go to the website, you'll also see, and I don't know whether you've still got it, Mike, but one of the walls in your house is a big chalk mural, isn't it?
We should have done the podcast in there. I got a big to-do list on it today. So I'm not going to expose everyone out to my 15 bulleted to-do list, but yeah, it's a full wall in the kitchen that's a chalkboard wall, and use it to as kind of like a, you know, different mural. Or if I ever have like an idea of something I want to, you know, put up on the wall, I'm able to do that. So it's pretty fun.
And do you wipe it clean every day, or do you just like keep stuff up there to remind? How does it work?
Yeah, sometimes I use it more for like a list or something to jot a note down. Those kind of things I'll wipe down every day. But a lot of times I'll use it if there's like a holiday coming up, or we're having like some people over or a party or something. If it's themed, or I don't know, if I just have an idea of something to put up, I'll try and do it because it's floor to ceiling, you know, end to end. I need a ladder and everything to kind of put the whole thing together. So I'm not erasing that every day. If I put something up that's full scale wall size, it's up for at least 3 or 4 weeks until I get bored of it. But a lot of times it'll be like I'll put something up for Christmas, and then, you know, come February, I'm kind of a little tired of seeing the Christmas stuff and I got to get rid of it. So, but it's a fun way of keeping things fresh. It's hard to pick out wall decor, I feel like, that doesn't get old after a while. So that helps.
Where did it come from? Because, I mean, you wouldn't always put accounting in, like, illustration and that. I mean, you know, everybody's different, right? But they don't often go hand in hand. So did it come from when you were young? I mean, is it always been a passion? How's that sort of emerged?
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for the kind words on like some of the drawings. It's funny, like I look at them as a little bit of a grade above maybe a doodle or like a cartoon. So that's not trying to put out the next Mona Lisa here, but yeah, it's mainly just been a hobby of mine growing up. Like, I think most people kind of draw when they're younger or doodle and things, and It's kind of funny because I think you have young kids too. I've got a kid in daycare now. They have like crayons out. They're drawing. They're doing arts and crafts every day. at a certain point, I don't know, middle school, seventh, eighth grade or something, you kind of stop doing that. The whole creative push from the educational institution kind of slows down. And I think people just kind of lose it. And then I think the other thing is if people draw something and it doesn't look like Mona Lisa, you know, they feel a little, there's criticism and people just kind of pull back. So they stop playing around with it. For the most part, I never got fully into it. Like I was drawing and trying to take an art route by any means, but I was always a big note taker. So I was always jotting little pictures down on the side of my notes. And then that's kind of progressed a little bit. I'm on a big team at work. And when I was living out in San Francisco, we used to do a card for everybody's birthday or work anniversary or engagement or any of those. Every day you'd have like there's 100 people on the team. There'd be like 3 cards on your desk. And they all said the same thing. Congratulations. Happy birthday. And for some reason, I didn't want to just say the same thing over and over again. So I would draw a little picture. And it ended up actually boosting my drawing skills pretty good just because I'm always drawing in these cards. And I started doing that. And that kind of got me into thinking, well, I wonder where else I could incorporate drawing into the accounting space. Because to your point, like it doesn't really go hand in hand. It's not like a natural marriage. But when COVID hit, everyone went work from home and collaboration got very clunky when you're, you know, as opposed to being in the office. And I started leveraging a digital whiteboard as like a go-to virtual tool that was perfect for collaboration when you have a distributed team like I do. And also when everyone's working remotely, working from home. So I started sketching out my team's ideas, my ideas on a digital whiteboard. We could all see it in front of us. The team could participate, drop sticky notes and YouTube videos and memes and stuff. And it was like a one pager of our meetings. And that was probably the first time I said, hey, that was actually kind of fun. Like that was a brainstorm session that was fun. I got to do a little bit of doodling and drawing, and it was actually very much solving problems and being productive. And that became a little bit of a whole thing. You know, I didn't see many other people doing that. Or even leveraging virtual tools beyond, hey, I can send a ping, I can use a Google Doc, and I can do Zoom. But that's the same stuff people use today that they used in the beginning of the pandemic. And there's all these virtual tools out there. So I started kind of playing around with the digital whiteboard, and that helped me incorporate, you know, the hobby side of drawing with actual productivity at work. And making it a little bit more fun, which I think in the accounting space, like you need all the fun you can get. So incorporating that made it a little bit more fun. And honestly, whenever you can bring in an outside interest to what you're getting paid to do and your actual work, you know, that's where fulfillment comes into play. And you know, you start to, you know, part of your work starts to feel like play. And I think that's a good thing.
And you really hit it there. Because play is different to everyone, isn't it? And I keep meaning to do this because, I mean, people can see there's like drum kits and guitars about and that yep. sort of stuff. And I feel like I've lost touch with it a little bit because, and can't blame the kids for everything, right? Because I still find the time to record podcasts and produce content and all of that sort of stuff. But I think it is important to find play wherever you can. And as you say, if you can sneak it into work, that's great. And I often find... And it's bizarre. I don't really categorize myself into, you know, visual learner or kinetic learner or, you know, audio learner or whatever the categories are. I kind of use a combination of all, I guess, like whatever works, right?
Yeah.
But when I'm at home, it's as you say, it's documents, spreadsheets, presentations. You know, it's very linear. You know, and whenever I go into the office and I meet with the team, the first thing that I do is go into the collab room and I draw all over the whiteboard. It is difficult simulating that remotely. So I'm curious to know from you, you say a virtual whiteboard. I get it. You know, I mean, we use Teams. It sounds like you use a bit of Zoom and all of that sort of stuff. but on Teams, it's very difficult to draw if you've got a keyboard and mouse. So do you have a tablet that's hooked up so that you can actually properly draw? How does that work? Because I've got a little tablet. I can't remember what the brand is, but to me, it's not big enough. Do you know what I mean? I can't actually move my hand enough. So yeah, it facilitates drawing, but it's just not, I just don't think it's ergonomically suitable for actually doing proper, like, big movements. So how do you do it?
Yeah, there is a hardware component to it. And so I have a tablet. It's a Galaxy tablet, I think S7, so maybe a generation or two behind, but comes with a stylus. It's called the S Pen. You know, it's not, I think it's partially a productivity kind of tablet, but really it's like an entertainment tablet. Like, it's not solely meant for, you know, virtual digital whiteboards and stuff, but it's very versatile. You can use it in that way. So that's one where, to your point, drawing or trying to write something out with your mouse, I mean, that's a pretty bad user experience. People aren't going to really do it. What I found too is that if I'm able to lead the session with the tablet and the stylus and get stuff out there, to ask everyone to do the exact same thing I'm doing is very daunting. And I think, you know, you give an accountant a pen and say, draw something or put something, you know, people kind of get scared and skittish. And in a collaborative environment, you're trying to have like an open, safe space. So what I like about digital whiteboards, drawing is the function I use a lot to kind of keep everything together and make it more dynamic. But other people are using other aspects of that whiteboard. Like I had mentioned, dropping in sticky notes, you can add text boxes, you can drop in a picture, you can do wireframing, you can draw arrows from one thing to another thing and videos. You can actually embed like a Google Sheet or a Google Doc. And if you update it in the whiteboard, it actually saves it into the cloud, like into the spreadsheet. So a lot of what I'm using it for is I'm probably the main one using the stylus and the sketching out the team's thoughts and ideas, trying to connect some of those dots. But others are using the other features that are maybe a little bit easier to use from the functions of the application of, you know, if you're using Miro or the, you know, like you mentioned, Zoom has a built-in whiteboard. Slack has another one. Teams has another one. They all have these digital whiteboards. In the finance space, if you were to take a poll, less than 5% of people are using them. You know, they exist everywhere. They're within five clicks of everybody, and nobody's using it. And for me, that also was like, well, maybe that's an opportunity. That whole aspect of a digital whiteboard is built for collaboration. And yet nobody in finance is using it that way. So there is some little hurdles, like you said, like not everybody's going to whip out a tablet or a style, you know, have the stylus and stuff. But you don't need everybody to. You really just need everyone participating in the discussion in whatever way they feel comfortable with. And a lot of people, even if they had the tablet, the best, they had the new Apple Pencil and tablet and everything, they're not going to feel comfortable, you know, writing stuff out on a digital whiteboard, and that's okay. I think you just gotta find what's the best way of getting the great insights that are in my team's head out onto something tangible that we can move around. And sometimes that could be in like, I'm sketching it out with the stylus, and sometimes that can be a text box that I'm dragging around. And I think that's what makes the tool really cool. And I'm always shocked that not that many people use it, but you know, that could change, you know, with the work from home shift becoming what looks to be permanent, at least in a hybrid way, people are gonna need to start to leverage those other tools because collaboration is very hard to do in a remote space. You mentioned it yourself. You get in a room, you can get on that whiteboard. That's very clunky to just pick that same process up and take it home. And eventually I think work from home is not going away. And I think leadership is gonna need to find ways of, you know, promoting some of these virtual tools and making sure that their staff are trained and upskill themselves to really lead a team in this new environment. Because for right now, nobody's really been trained in how to lead a team virtually. It kind of just is like, go wing it and I hope you can do it, you know? So it's a funny time to be in corporate America or even in the business world, I'd say.
Yeah. And I struggle. So I'm fully remote. I go into the office once a week and it's great. you know, because that's the day of meetings and we can collaborate. You know, it's mm-hmm. one of the company values is collaboration. But from a remote perspective, it's difficult to distance yourself from a world outside of a screen, a keyboard and a mouse. Yeah. And just as you've been talking through that, I've got an iPad, like quite a nice iPad. It's an iPad Pro. So I probably need to find a way to hook that up to my PC, don't I? And just use it as an interface. I can probably do that, yeah. right? I'm sure there's a way of doing that.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the stuff is in the cloud. So, you know, if you can share your screen, which everybody knows how to share their screen in a virtual meeting, you just pull up a new tab and you pull up a digital whiteboard. You know, it's or you use the built-in application through the interface of like Teams or whatever. So that's what I was saying. It is so easy. You don't need some fancy HDMI converter to USB-C to lightning cable. You don't need any of that. So the barrier to entry isn't necessarily the tech. That's kind of why I didn't mention it too much. I think it's there. I think the barrier to entry is just, it's an atypical way for accountants to work and other finance professionals. But when you see it happen and people are engaged, I think it's hitting all the right notes. And if you look at other, you know, I'm fortunate to work with occasionally some other design teams and engineer teams and product managers. To them, that's a fluent way of doing something is to jump on a whiteboard and you know, workflow out something. And the collaboration is really fun to be a part of. That hasn't translated to the business teams, even though it's working so well on one side of the house. And I think it's unfortunate, but it's also, I think, ripe for opportunity. There's no reason we don't use it other than it's unfamiliar.
I think realizing it, I think most people remember visuals more than heavy text or even like slide decks, especially if they see stuff being created in front of them. So they say, obviously, a picture paints 1,000 words, right? And that's true. But I'll caveat that by saying that seeing a picture being drawn goes a step further than that, because in my view, it helps internalize the A to B, the step one to step two, if you can see the way that it is built up in the way that you're saying you're doing. So when you have one of these sessions, what's your go-to visual? Is it like a central theme and then you've got your strands branching out with input, or is it more like a process flow? Are we talking boxes connect with arrows? What's the, I'm just trying to match up the sort of conversation that you'd have as an accounting team and how that makes its way onto a visual discussion versus a sharing documents and slide discussion.
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think maybe that's one of the biggest barriers is when you're looking at a blank page or a blank whiteboard, it's very daunting. You know, like we always talk about being able to succeed and navigate ambiguity. There's nothing more ambiguous than a blank piece of paper, you know, or something like that. So the recommendation I give, and I actually have a course out there called Sketchy Business Practices, which gets into this a little bit more. But one of the tips I give is if you don't know what to do, draw a circle and put the topic in the middle of it. And then it just becomes a mind map. You have the spokes that come off of it with the different ideas that your team is shouting. That'll usually highlight a theme. You know, you step back and you look at what kind of theme is coming from that. Maybe it's a problem to solve. Maybe it's a process efficiency that seems kind of clunky. Maybe it's a sequence of events type thing that you're trying to work through. And then basically from there, you can say, well, what's a good next step to kind of tease out this brain dump that was just done in a mind map with a circle and a bunch of spokes? What's the best way to move forward with that? Because it's not always going to be a flow chart isn't going to fit for everything. A timeline isn't going to fit for everything. And a part of that is, you know, I have a section that I break down the different elements to try to break it down into five elements. And one of them is frameworks, which is no different than how we all use templates. You know, everybody uses templates, especially in accounting with financials and rolling over work papers. Everything is a template. Like very few things start from scratch. So once you have like some templates in mind of, oh, here's what a timeline could look like. Here's now, here's the future state. What are all the pieces in between? Then it makes it a little easier to start filling in the blanks. Or maybe you're trying to solve a root cause. And maybe that's a picture of a tree with a bunch of roots. And at the top is all the things that you see as pain points. What's the underlying things down in the roots, you know? Or parts of a whole is another good one too, where when you say parts of a whole, that could be like, well, how much manpower hours does it take to finish this spreadsheet as far as the entire close process for the quarter? So you can see what are the areas that maybe there could be process efficiencies. I mean, that's as simple as like a pie chart, you know, breaking it down into different sections to visually show what's represents a greater piece of it. You could do a picture of a pizza with different slices missing, or a test tube with different levels of liquid in it, and a thermometer with a heat check. Like, there's a million things that are all kind of the same variation of a parts of a whole. And so anyway, I think a lot of the ways that I'll do it, I have a handful of frameworks that I feel like can work in a lot of those situations. Because most of the time, it's probably a sequence, a timeline, a decision between option A or option B is another one that happens a lot. Or it's just the brainstorming, let's see where it goes, which is more of the mind map, which is like, you know, the circle with the spokes and the, you know, the popcorn idea there and things coming off of that. So it all starts with the framework. There's no one size fits all, but it's also, again, I'm not looking at this as art. In the team environment, I'm looking at it as a productivity tool. And I think to your point about people appreciating the process, they're not looking for art either. You know, if you can do a funny little picture that goes along with it, like, that's great. And it kind of makes it more fun, but you don't really need that. It's not about the art. It's about the process and just getting your ideas down. So to me, I think it's more valuable. You mentioned like being able to get a picture out of your mind and onto paper without the AI. Like, I feel like the power is being able to do that quickly, not in come back to me in 2 weeks and I'll have a beautiful picture for you. Like, that doesn't interest me. My attention span's too short for that. Like, I'll lose interest and have a million other things I want to do. But if I can think of something really quick and I can get it down very quick, that's pretty powerful. And so again, it gets back to, you're not shooting for perfection. You're just trying to get the team's ideas down. And once people see those ideas, you know, our brains have a certain amount of working memory. Once you put it down on paper or on a digital whiteboard, it allows you to say, okay, I don't need to think about that anymore. It's already there. What else can I free up my headspace to think about? I can always come back to that. And usually by the end of the session, I step back and try to do some sort of an analysis on, well, where do we stand now? And I connect some dots and we issue out some action items for the various members of the team. And we're all have the same unified vision, and we all are going about the same plan, and we can go execute after that. And it feels like a very team-oriented approach, where it's not me telling you, go do this. We all came up with this. The ideas came from our discussion. And then it makes it a little easier to motivate people to kind of go forth and work on that project, because it's not like a directive, Mike told me to go do this, so I'm doing it. Like, this is a team thing. We all bought into it. So that's what collaboration really, you know, is the byproduct of collaboration, which is why everyone likes to say collaboration is important, but I don't know that everyone is that great at collaborating.
Yeah. Collaboration is not sitting in a room and going through some KPIs, you know, it's not a review of what's good versus last week versus what's bad versus last week. You know, that's not collaboration. That could be done remotely. You know, that might not even be a meeting. You know, that might just be like a one pager, right. You know, or a video that I could record of myself running through a slide deck. You know, that's reporting. That's not collaboration. So you say the collaboration comes from that shared idea piece, and coming back to what you've just said there in terms of inspiring and having people take something away, I think you're absolutely right, because firstly, there's an extra element of joy in the meeting. Yeah, so they're likely to be more receptive and more excited about sitting in a meeting with Mike. Oh, I love getting into meetings with Mike because, you know, he draws all these cool characters and, you know, everything makes so much sense because I can see it on one page. Mm-hmm. And then that energy continues outside the collaboration piece, which then in turn is more likely to lead to better results come the next meeting because they remember where they were, they're inspired to do something next. Yeah. So if you can keep that momentum going, it's a lot better than people thinking, oh, have I really got to go into that other meeting where we just talk about the numbers again?
Or, let me share my slide deck. And you mentioned, like, here's a bunch of blocks of text. Let me go to slide 1 of 50. Man, you lost the whole team, you know? And if you look at any good sales materials or the last product that any of us bought, it's not a whole block of text or, you know, 15 pages you got to read. It's a one pager with a few big things trying to get your attention. And that's the type of way that I think is engaging to people. They don't want to have to sift through a bunch of slide deck presentations. Or if you're just going to get and present and read verbatim off of the deck, why did you need a live meeting for that? You could have recorded a Loom, to your point, or like you could have just shared the deck with me. Like, what's the point of that? And that's why I think the stat is something like team engagement, I think, for managers now in a virtual environment is 3 to 4 times harder than in the office. And I think that's not because I want to go back to the office 5 days a week. I think why I push this so hard that there is a good way of doing collaboration virtually is because I don't want to go back to the office 5 days a week. So don't say you got to go back because collaboration is falling short and our teams aren't engaged. That's a scapegoat. That's a cop-out answer. You can do those things virtually. You just need people that can do it. You need to train your people the right way, get them onto tools to actually do it. Because it can be very engaging. It can be very collaborative. But at least in my opinion, I've been in a lot of big firms and a couple Fortune 500s, and this has been true everywhere. You go into a meeting with 10 plus people. You look around the room. Most people are on mute in the virtual environment. Not that many. God forbid, maybe a few cameras are off. You know, who knows what's happening there? And then if you ask anybody have any questions or comments, most likely you're going to get radio silence. Second most likely, there's going to be 1 to 2 people that chime in that just so happen to be the same 1 to 2 people that always chime in. Well, what about the other 8 people? You know what I mean? And I think that's not engagement. That's not engagement, you know, and it's a challenge that I think we all face. And that could happen in a live meeting too, in a room. But I think when you're having lunch with somebody, you're having a coffee chat, and then you go jump in a room and you're looking at them in the eye, you're sitting next to them, they're probably more likely to speak up than having to raise their hand feature or I don't want to talk over somebody, so they go off mute. Like, it's a small little barrier in a virtual environment, but I feel like it keeps a lot of people quiet that otherwise might be more outspoken. And I think the execs are saying, oh, we got to go back to the office, which I feel like is not the answer either.
You've got to get a balance. And from my perspective, time with people is very important.
Yeah.
But time by yourself for deep work is also very important. So the more easy that you can segment, these are the meetings where we need the energy, you know, we need to bring it, versus the deep work that people can do themselves, the better, mm-hmm. you know. But especially in larger organizations, it's always difficult, right? Because if you're giving people the flexibility to work on their own schedule, so you say we've got a hybrid working policy that's, you know, 3 days at home, 2 days in the office, or 2 days at home, 3 days in the office, then managing the people that are going to be on site on that day, that becomes a logistical nightmare in itself, doesn't it? So it's impossible to be able to say everybody's in on Thursday for these meetings.
Yeah.
Because you're going to be met with pushback, you know, and that then loses the whole premise of hybrid working, which is flexibility in working environment. So yes, it's not an easy task at all.
Yeah. It is a little bit of a catch-22 because people complain if they come into the office and their team isn't there. Because they say, what was the point of me coming in if I'm just going to sit on a video conference all day? Valid point. But then if you tell them, okay, let's all come in on Thursday, then you got people saying, well, don't tell me when to come in. Like, I have 3 days. I get to pick and choose. So it's a slippery slope, like, especially with the bigger team. My team, the team I manage, is a size of five. We've all tried to make a best effort. It's funny you mentioned Thursday. We make a best effort to come in on Thursday. Whatever you do with your other 2 days, it doesn't matter what days those are. But if we can, let's try to be in the office on Thursday. Obviously, stuff comes up. But that just gives us a better chance of being able to run into each other. It sounds like we structure it similar to your one day in the office, where that's a very live, meeting-heavy day. Our brainstorm meetings are that day. We have team lunches and all those things, because I agree, like, I don't personally want to never see my team in person. Like, I want some of that. I think there is value to that, but it doesn't need to be 5 days a week. It can definitely be less than that. But it's hard, because trying to get everyone on the same schedule is one part of the challenge. The other part of the challenge is, I mean, most in bigger organizations especially, but even in smaller organizations where you're outsourcing pieces of your work or subcontracting, you probably have a distributed team anyway, where they're living across the country, or, you know, you're in the UK and I'm in Chicago in the US. Like, it doesn't matter. We're never going to be able to all get into the same office. That's not an excuse to say we never work with anybody outside of our local location. That's kind of an ancient way of thinking. So there might, even in those hybrid situations where the team that sits in Chicago with me is there with me on Thursday in the room, I still have people in LA that are video conferencing in, and other people from Austin, Texas conferencing in. I'm not going to get around that. But it's about as close as you can get to all being in one room at the same time. And so that's what we shoot for. But it definitely takes, you know, a lot of people getting on the same page and being flexible too with, if you're trying to get the ideal scenario where you're all singing Kumbaya in one boardroom, it's probably not going to happen even in the best case scenario, you know?
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see how it goes, because, I mean, forgetting about the AI piece for a second, which of course is gone mad recently, people, maybe because they're distracted by the AI piece, aren't seeing some of the amazing stuff that's happening with hardware. So you mentioned, obviously, your Galaxy Tab, which is, you know, your hardware that enables you to do the whiteboarding sessions. But I kind of feel like, was it the latest Apple release? I can't remember the headset, which was the augmented reality piece. And there was YouTube videos of, like, teenagers sitting on the train, like, you know, working through his, because he had it in a, like, a virtual reality environment around him, right? And I feel like they've been downplayed a little bit because there's been a, you know, more interesting and more sort of, like, job threatening focus. Oh, I don't care about a headset. I'm worried about, you know, how AI is going to take over my job. But I think it's important to see that. And I read something today as well about smart contact lenses, which I had not heard of before. I'd heard about the smart glasses, and I've seen the adverts, you know, for the Ray-Bans that have got, like, the little, you know, the little lenses that can produce visuals, like a heads-up display sort of thing. But they're now creating technology that these smart lenses can charge themselves from the moisture in your eyes. Wow. You know, and that it is insane. That's absolutely insane. You know, so right now we're talking about how there's a barrier to you and I sitting on the other side of the world to each other. But I don't think it's going to be long before we can sit in our pod, you know, so I won't have an office. I'll have an office pod with a 360 surround or a visor or whatever. I can almost sit with somebody in person because we're both in the metaverse. And I know the metaverse is, there's been a lot of hype around that. I think namely because people don't understand it, and also because nobody's actually really managed to illustrate clear use cases apart from putting on some goggles and pretending you're like some sort of cartoon avatar. Yeah, so it's not real enough yet, but it will come. But I'm interested to see where it goes, because we talked a little bit about energy there, you know, and to use another example from today. So I was one of the few that was actually remote today. And there was a team of eight in the office that I was leading a session with. And people know me, like, I'm quite happy chappy, you know, I'm quite energetic. I've got a lot to say, right? So it's been a useful exercise for me having these podcasts because it trains me not to speak over people, which is what I used to do that quite a lot. But I was bringing the energy on my side through my camera. But for whatever reason, I don't know what happened in the office, but the eight people on the other side of the camera, it was like somebody died. And I don't know what had gone in the office, but there are eight people that were highly distracted. And their mind was obviously somewhere else. And I can jump around and, you know, swing my arms and shout as much as I like, but my energy isn't going to compensate for the combined lack of energy across the eight people in the room. Yeah. So the reason I mention that is, yes, we might in the future have the tech that enables us to virtually place ourselves next to each other, but are we going to have the physical energy? And I don't know. You know, that's a bigger question, I guess. But I think it's one thing to be better connected and be able to draw on a whiteboard and have people patch in and you see people's cameras and that sort of stuff. But it's the energy that comes from those meetings in that collaborative environment that is the way that you then create that momentum that you inspire and do whatever. You know, you think of like massive arenas, massive keynote speeches where people get standing ovations. It's because you've got that combined energy in the room. You've got that like groupthink, you know, that hive mind that's all kind of in sync. And I think that's going to be really... Anyway, I've gone a bit meta there. Like, yeah, I mentioned the metaverse, but that is a bit meta. But I think it's an interesting thought experiment because I think the hardware will catch up soon. It's just how we adopt it at the end of the day. But that's the biggest problem, you know, with all tech and all business change is the adoption.
Yeah, I think you bring up a good point. And, you know, I totally see the tech being there too. That's why I don't think the right answer is to go back to how we did it pre-COVID, because I definitely think things have already moved forward well beyond that. As far as never going back to the always being in the office, it'll either be hybrid, and the hybrid version will probably be more of this virtual type environment. And maybe that's in a Vision Pro where somebody's holding a meeting on the train, right? Or maybe it's the metaverse example, which I agree. I think the rollout of that was clunky because everybody looked like a cartoon, but the concept made a lot of sense. And I think that tech is pretty close to being there. Well, maybe not close to being there, but close to rolling out to the masses and actually seeing that happen. But the point that you raised about being able to do everything you want, to be engaging and still not being able to control the temperature in another room, I think part of that is that I'd like to think that technology will help with that, because even in, like, say, a metaverse experience or maybe a Vision Pro with everybody feeling like they're in the same room, it's much harder to do some of the things that would normally be considered rude, which is like obviously not paying attention. And we're all distracted by a million. If it's not your phone or your watch, it's somebody's pinging you on your laptop. The fact that somebody's presenting a slide deck on the screen, you've already tried to do a million other things. But once you feel like you're in the room, it is a little harder to just disengage, you know? And I think whether you engage because you're in the room or you engage because you feel like you're in the room, I'm hoping that that's something that tech does solve, number one. And then number two, I'm hoping that just the environment and the way that the presentation goes, because I do think a lot of it is the way you present. There's plenty of boring speakers out there who could have the exact same message, read the exact same cue cards as somebody with a lot of maybe charisma and stage presence, and one gets a standing ovation and the other gets a couple silent claps, you know? So a lot of that is the energy, but I also think it's what you're doing, energy plus the tools that you're using at that time. Like I keep hating on the slide deck, which is funny because I at least present the slide deck a day. But the whole point is, like, you know, how you're using that, I think, does matter. Like, for instance, I was working on a digital ad campaign for a big DNA company that, you know, you would know if I said the name of it. And they were going through how come my ad campaign isn't doing as well for the advertising spend that I'm doing. And they went through, and it was a quick clip. It didn't have any audio. and it was kind of like stock photo type stuff. And the team I was working with, the YouTube team, was giving the rundown of all the reasons as to why, or ways that it can be better. And one of them was, obviously, add music. You have to appeal to the different senses, right? Sometimes senses is hard to get in a virtual environment. So play some audio with that and develop the relationship, like kind of pull, like what emotion are you trying to invoke from that? If you're not invoking a emotion, it's easy for that person to not be engaged. And then the other thing was the visuals they were using were very stock. Even if you look at the AI images that everyone likes to play around with now, like show me a unicorn playing on the drum set on the moon. You can do that and that's cool. It's a good, like a novelty kind of thing, but it's all starting to look the same. And one day that's going to look like the old clip art. And one of the things that came out of that presentation from the YouTube team was hand-drawn images, because they're imperfect, they stop the scroll. And people, it catches their eye because it's different, because most people aren't doing that. So I think there's more of that. Yes, it's the tech. Yes, it's the engaging leader. But it's also what tools are you using within that environment to evoke emotion outside of the engagement, outside of the leader being engaging. How are you appealing to their senses with the right visuals and the right sound stuff, and maybe even like haptic feedback if I were to reach and shake your hand? Like, there could be stuff like that, you know, and I'm very interested to see where it goes. And if anything, I think it's encouraging. I think it's going to make the business more global, even though it already kind of is. And I'm also really curious, just to pivot the conversation a little bit, as to how does that impact like accounting and finance professionals? You know, I'm in the States, so how does it impact the accounting and finance professionals that are US based, which right now there's a big shortage. I think there is probably globally too for finding those staff, but you know, that's going to put a pressure on wages, and people can continue to increase compensation, which I hope they do, right? Employers, I hope that they do. But at some point, if you're in this global environment and you take time zones out of it and you can all put on a headset and feel like you're in the same room, is that opportunity going to go to this high paid US CPA, or is it going to go to somebody in the Philippines or India who's doing it for a fraction of the cost, which in the past used to kind of be frowned upon because it felt like you wanted to keep it local. I think once you become more global, boundaries are blurred big time. And that shortage that everyone's talking about, is it not as acute as we all think it is, because it's just going to be filled with global workers? It's another thing that I'm curious to see how it plays out too, because it's probably really good for those overseas, maybe doing the offshore services. Might not be so great for the local teams that are looking for the increased compensation and is maybe going slower than they thought. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, we'll just end up building side hustles, right?
maybe the W-2 employee is, or I guess I should say maybe like the 40-hour week employee is now fractioned off, and maybe everyone has three or four kind of jobs. I don't know.
Really quick, guys, as you know, I don't run ads and I no longer sell anything on here. So to help me, it'd be great if you could share with just one other person, leave a review, give a thumbs up and subscribe. It really does make a difference. Now back to the show.
I can see it. So, you know, we have the tools now for people to build, you know, small businesses easier than ever. Yes, maybe the large organizations will be able to justify heavier amounts of outsourcing potentially if that's part of their business plan. But smaller businesses, you know, that are very much still in the same location and, you know, need to build centrally, they might need fractional support. You never know. I mean, I've seen a bit of a trend, especially in the SME space, towards CFOs becoming more fractional.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe A is probably the money, you know, and they think, right, well, I've got to CFO now and I can either get the next grade of CFO role or I can just go fractional and work less time and earn the same amount of money, or if not more money. So it will be interesting to see how it goes. But then you've obviously got then the the whole economic situation, which, you know, I have no knowledge of global economics, so mm-hmm. you know, I am by no means the expert in saying this, but at some point the other economies will have to catch up. You know, right now there's a big variance in pay based on, you know, cost of living and all of, you know, the various currency conversions and whatever. But as all of these sort of poorer, in inverted commas, regions across the world get more prosperous and they get more teched up, there's going to be less of a gap between salaries, I think. I mean, the horizon is obviously much further away than now. Yeah. And of course, you know, I do it, you know, so I outsource some of my work to people in Bangladesh and the Philippines and all sorts, because they're still bright people.
Yeah.
But it costs me $6 an hour instead of 60. Yeah.
And how do you turn that down? You know,
that's it. That's yeah. it. But I think that there will always be a job for intelligent humans. You know, but I hope there is. And we've spoken before on the podcast, and we've got super deep into like future of AI and all of that sort of stuff. We don't have to do that today. But I think you definitely raise a valid point. But just bringing it back a second, I wanted to, before I forget, just drill you a little bit more on what you said about the work that you did with that customer, you know, in terms of the advice around, you know, does it need to be more visual? Does it need to be more, some of the stuff that you said there. It's interesting that you got involved in those conversations. Is that a regular occurrence or?
I wouldn't say necessarily a regular occurrence, but that's also, I consider myself a creative person. The fact that I'm at Google, which is a creative company that's always looking for creative people, that's not by accident. That was kind of where I thought I might thrive. And not everybody wants to hear from the accountant the next greatest idea, you know, whereas I feel like I do get a little bit more of a seat at the table. One, you have to earn. But if you can earn that seat at the table, people will listen and there's opportunities to chime in. So in that case, you know, the space that I'm in is I support the ad revenue side of it. So I handle the accounting for all of, not me personally, but the 100-person team for all of Google Search and YouTube and some other products, which is, for anybody who doesn't know, Google's mainly a digital ad business, is where we get mm-hmm. most of the revenue. So it's a big chunk of the business. And I work on a pretty cool segment, which is working with sales teams that are working with our big advertising clients, trying to get them to invest more in digital ad spend across the Google properties, and then to adopt our latest products. Whenever we're pushing a new product, how can we get our biggest customers to take advantage of that? And that usually involves coming up with some deal of, hey, you spend some more money, I'll give you some discounts, I'll run some free impressions on your next, you know, World Cup campaign, kind of stuff like that, and different incentive packages that are pretty customized based on, you know, whether you're talking about a McDonald's or a Netflix. Like the package is going to be very different. Whereas in this in that scenario, I represent the accounting team, and I'm sitting in a virtual room with somebody who's representing the legal team and the compliance team and the engineering team and the sales team and the FP&A team. And that's where sort of some of those, you know, when people think you're in accounting, they probably are thinking you're working with a bunch of other accountants. And they may not think of it that you're doing a very cross-functional role, which there's a lot of cross-functional roles in the accounting space. That's why everyone keeps saying soft skills are so important. It's not soft skills are important so that you can talk to another accountant. That's easy. We're speaking the same language. But go try and speak some accounting to like a sales lead or somebody in Eng or somebody, you know, legal actually picks it up pretty quick. But like those kind of things, I feel like people don't necessarily think of accounting as a very cross-functional aspect. So in those cases, I'd get brought into deals like that, where it's like, hey, we're trying to do this deal. In this case, what's the biggest pain point for the customer? They're trying to get better reach on their campaigns. And I'm sitting in the room for some of that, not all of it client, most of it's not client facing, but very much like structuring what we're trying to do. And you know, if you're working with sales teams, they're trying to do everything. I'm going to offer everything under the sun. And sometimes they got to get reined in. Well, that's going to really complicate things on my end. And trying to get those sales teams to care that what they're proposing is going to be a nightmare on the accounting side. So that's sort of how I fit into the organization. It's probably a pretty unique side of the business, but it's, you know, maybe 15-20% accounting, and the rest is like project work and automation. And, you know, my whole team can write in SQL, and we're writing scripts and workflows and things like that. So it's a little different than maybe a typical accounting team, but that's the part that I love too. You know, it's not a let me box in this accounting person to do accounting stuff. You know, I have the freedom to kind of stretch a lot of what it means to be an accountant, you know. And I know a lot of your guests, I feel like, really stretch those boundaries too. And I think that's part of why I was so excited to come and chat with you, because I think a lot of what you talk about pushes the envelope, I think, of maybe tradition.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it is a bit of a niche. You know, I don't have a ton of followers. I mean, you know, maybe coming up to 1,000, over 1,000 followers now, which, I mean, for podcasts, it's not bad going, right?
Yeah,
I mean, we're coming up to 70 episodes now. But yeah, I mean, I'm always keen on a different perspective, because it's not just about the tech that sits in the middle, as we know too well. You know, the tech is the enabler. You know, that the people have still got to do the job on top of it. And you mentioned automation, they're writing scripts and that mm-hmm. sort of stuff. I mean, is it your standard Excel like VBA type stuff, or have you got an automation platform that's like the go-to for that sort of, you're using like Power Automate? That, oh, I probably shouldn't say with you being Google, right? Probably not using probably not using the Microsoft stack. So what does automation look like to you without giving away too many secrets?
Yeah, it's not Excel, which is, you know, the few things that every accountant knows. I was like to consider myself an Excel wizard, but now I'm a Google Sheets wizard, I guess. So yeah. That's pretty much the standard, is you're not using Excel anymore, you're using Sheets, which for all intents and purposes is the same, if not maybe a little better. I guess I'm a little biased, but then outside of that, so there's different variations of, like, we'll do our own homegrown type automation stuff. And that's usually through SQL. I don't know how familiar you are with SQL, but,
yeah.
You know, joining different data sets and pulling different reports and developing Plex dashboards and things like that, and creating different workflows that automate a lot of, you know, manual things that we would normally do. That could be like generating a journal entry from a bunch of data, but, you know, putting in all the debits and credits and all those kind of things to fit into SAP nice and neatly. And then also writing scripts that validate stuff, like, can I read from the contract tables to make sure that whatever payment I'm about to approve aligns with what's in the contract? Sure, I could go open it up the old school way and check, validate everything. Or I can run a script that's feeding off of the tables that generated the contract. And those kind of things that I think is the more exciting side of accounting that maybe people don't talk about a lot. But there's a lot there. And it's funny because people talk about AI like it's automation is a new thing. But automation has been at the top of every accounting team's to-do list for a decade at least. And I think a lot of people are still just doing stuff in Excel workbooks. And yeah. There's a lot in the middle that you can do. You don't necessarily need an AI product or like a co-pilot type thing to solve that. You know, I think sometimes maybe this is where some of the AI, I think, is maybe a little overhyped. And then I think everyone's looking for this one-click solution to solve everything that I'm doing. And they're skipping a lot of stuff in the middle, which is, look, you want full-blown automation, but you're not even doing the mid-grade automation. And you're trying to go too far. Like, why don't you start like automating some of the stuff you can yourself? And that's the difference between creating a script and a workflow, creating the automation, which is the stuff I was just talking about, versus what I think what most people want in the accounting space, which is to be a user of an app or something that somebody else created.
Yeah.
And there's a huge market for that. But I think at the end of the day, you can't just be a user. You got to be able to do some of the stuff yourself. There's a power to that, and in the creation process. And you know, you were mentioning, not to go backwards here, but like you were mentioning like the creative side of the drawing thing, or even you playing drums in an ambiguous situation. Like you sit at that drum set, You got right hand on the drumstick hitting the hi-hat, left on the snare drum, left foot on the hi-hat pedal, right foot on the kick drum pedal, and then you're trying to crash the toms and the cymbals in an interlude while you have some sort of rhythm. That's a lot of multitasking. That's completely ambiguous to sit down at a drum set and hand two sticks and say, play something. You know, that creativity, just like in drawing and an ambiguous blank page, it comes into play when you sit down and you're looking at this workbook with a million different tabs in it and you're thinking, how can I make this better? And I'm looking to see what's taking all the time. Why am I spending, you know, till 11 p.m. every night trying to do this accounting work? What's taking the most time? How can I improve that process? What pieces can I automate? And if you don't know how to automate anything, at least a little bit, like from a minimum viable product standpoint, then you're never going to be able to say, I can take this piece of data and that piece of data and join it into the data that I need, and then I can do this that actually books my journal entry for me. That's a lot of creativity right there. And I don't know that people think of it that way, but you know, you being a musician or an artist or any sort of creative side of anybody, I think people think they check it at the door when they come into the accounting space. That's on them if they check it at the door. There's plenty of opportunity to flex that within your day-to-day, but you got to flex it.
You put that so eloquently, and I think you just riffing, pardon the pun, on my drum kit there. No, that was a great analogy because you're absolutely right. I mean, there is... There's a certain amount of muscle memory that you need to build, you know, and that's why they say when you pick up a guitar that you never lose it because you've done the reps. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I've probably not picked up the guitars for, you know, a few weeks, maybe coming up to a month now. I can see the dust on them. They need a good clean. But you go back into that memory of that repeat activity to build that skill in the first place. And where AI has the edge, I guess, is it's almost being programmed with that muscle memory, which is why AI is pretty good at generating code, you know, because there's so much of it to be trained on. You know, the amount of code on the internet, you know, is amazing. You talk about taking a template from here, taking a template from here. That's all the AI is doing, you know, is it's saying logically this plus this is the, or sorry, logically this is the result of this query based on the most common, you know, data sets that I'm working from and all that sort of stuff. But coming back to the automation piece, I think because AI is still such a hype, is people fall into the trap of thinking that AI and automation are the same thing, mm-hmm. when they're totally not. And the way that I describe it is seeing automation as a digital pair of hands. So it is doing a sequence of events in the same way that you would, you know, chop up a carrot. Or that's a bad example because you can chop up a carrot in so many different ways, but like you know, click a button on a screen, you know, highlight a different cell, you know, update this formula, all of that sort of stuff, you know, whereas AI is digital brain and therefore should be used to support cognitive tasks rather than repeat tasks. Do you see what I mean? And that's when I have my discussions and we talk about AI, I think in terms of augmentation and reducing that mental fatigue and expanding yourself with a digital brain versus trying to get AI to automate stuff, because it is not a cookie cutter. You know, the variance in the sort of responses you're likely to get from AI is very different to writing a script, as you say, you know, or performing a SQL query. You know, if you write a SQL query with these parameters from this data set, you will get exactly the same result every time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No creativity required, no temperature, you know, nothing like that. You know, if I do this, then I will 100% get that. As soon as you go into the AI space, there is not that certainty anymore. You know, you can't say for certain that if you give an AI a complex equation or a complex problem to figure out, that it's going to give the same answer every time. You know, there's a good chance it will be accurate because the models are getting better and better, right? Mm-hmm. But the working out is going to be different, you know? So you being able to have that base knowledge to be able to guide is going to be so important. And I've been having conversations about, have you heard of this... this Devin tool? You hear about the release of Devin?
A little bit, not the details though.
Yeah, so cool. It's an autonomous agent that prompts itself. So instead of you having to continuously prompt the AI and give prompt to say, now do this, now do this, you just give it an outcome and say, I want you to build this, and it works it back itself. Wow. Yeah, so it'll create its own prompts, you know, and it will seek out and do that problem solving piece to try and get to the output that it wants. One of the guys online, Ethan Mollick, sets it on Reddit. You know, so he basically set Devin up with a Reddit user so that it could post and gain feedback from the users in the community. So it was basically, you know, what do you want? Like, I'm building this, how can I make it better and all that sort of stuff. It started trying to charge people. Like, you know, it read it itself, right, what's this worth to you? Do you see what I mean? You know,
going through a monetization strategy.
That's where the premise of autonomy gets a little bit scary because it's very difficult to determine fact from fiction when something is masquerading as an intelligent person. But of course, with the right questions, you'd be able to find it out. But the reason I mentioned that is somebody picked it apart. I can't remember his name because otherwise I'd mention it here. But he said the actual doing is maybe 20-30% of the job. Like, you know, the actual writing the code is such a small portion of that activity. Wow. You know, 70% of the time is collaborating with other people to define what do you want from it. You know, it's that iterative process that spans more than just the activity of doing something that takes up a lot of time. And that's, you know, that's where autonomy focused on one task isn't going to work. And that's where the scary piece with general intelligence comes, is if you imagine an automated bot in the same way that Devin works, but then combined across all sorts of different tasks and functions, you know, that can then essentially act as a human brain. And that's where it gets a little bit scary. But I still don't think we've got the compute power, but there we go. Anyway, how are we doing for time, Mike?
I mean, I got a little bit more time if we want to keep chatting. I mean, that Devin thing sounds insane. Like, I feel like everybody was shifting to, I just got to, you know, let's prompt engineer is going to be the next big job. But you've already got an AI doing the prompts for you. So that's pretty wild. And even I was using an AI product, and then, not to belabor the point, it's called a Notebook LM, which is really powerful too, but that was one where you can upload a document and you can ask it questions about the document, and it'll, you know, instead of you having to scan the 50-page document, it'll synthesize and it'll answer all your questions, basically like your own little chatbot for a particular document, or in some cases tons and tons of documents. I was using it for a work thing, and I had all these questions I was asking it, and I was mainly seeing how good it was. But it wasn't the fact that it was answering the questions, pulling the right parts of the document and answering it the right way. It was suggesting things of like, maybe you should ask these questions, which I was like, whoa. Well, like, if my role is to be able to ask hard questions that maybe people aren't thinking about to make sure, you know, the diligence is there. Well, I thought at least that was going to be safe, you know, and there's this AI basically asking really insightful questions that I was like, damn, I guess, you know, all of this it's moving fast. You know, I think things are moving just as fast as you had a prompt engineer being the next big thing. You got to learn how to write the prompt. You have another AI tool that's writing the prompts too, and then acting on the results of the prompt output. Yeah. It's a wild time.
It's crazy. And nobody knows the future. I mean, we can make an educated guess, but what I can say is with the finance teams that I've worked with, it is still a real struggle to find legitimate AI use cases past personal productivity. Yeah. So I'm a big fan of AI for speeding up writing process documentation, you know, helping with tricky decisions, you know, using it as a sounding board, as I say, using it as a second brain to speed up and, you know, reduce that mental fatigue, you know, to become more efficient, right? But then in a business setting, that's where it gets really tricky, you know, because again, I don't think even some of the best developers yet still truly understand how to deploy, say, like an OpenAI model, AI model mm-hmm. within a company infrastructure. And I'm sure people are doing it. Obviously, ChatGPT Enterprise is, you know, on that premise. It's meant to be built into your data. But it still needs training, you know, because a language model that's optimized for chat from a personal perspective isn't going to work if it spans multiple disparate sets of company data. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not yet going to have an AI that spans department that can write SQL queries to produce the results that you want in the format that you want to see them in. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it might come, but it's still, I feel like, you know, AI at the moment has been just good enough and just impressive enough for everybody to adopt it because it can act as that ultimate productivity tool from a personal perspective. Yeah. But I feel from a business perspective, when we start looking into autonomy and the ability to instantly recall data and, you know, make informed decisions by just having a Q&A with your bot across, you know, especially mm-hmm. for companies like yours, where you say you've got huge amounts of data, huge amounts of disparate systems, that's a way off. But I'll be eating my words in 12 to 24 months because the rate of change is that we can't even predict where it's going to be, you know? And I've been saying to a couple of people that, you know, if you were literally just hands off with AI at the moment and decided to revisit it in 6 months, you'll have better tools. So you might spend the next 6 months implementing the current capability, whereas you might as well wait 6 months and do it twice as fast because the tools are better.
Yeah.
You see what I mean? But it's that balance, because you've got to do something in the interim because there are some efficiency gains to be gained from doing it. But one recommendation that I've got for you, and I'd be interested to get your feedback on it. So you mentioned Notebook LM is a tool that you use. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of Jedda.ai?
No. Is that with a J or a G?
J. Jedda.ai.
No.
And it comes back to what you were saying previously about speed. So yeah, why would I use an AI to create an image or try and create a process flow diagram that I've then got to go through loads of iterations because it wasn't what I wanted and I've got to reprompt and re-ask the question or whatever, when I can just draw it because I've got the vision in my head and I just want to draw it. Now, Jedda obviously won't do that, but they refer to it as a generative AI workspace. And as I'll send you the link, but if you log into it, you are met with a virtual whiteboard. Yeah. Ooh. And it will give you pre-canned visualizations. Yeah. So whether it's a mind map or a process flow, so you can say, create me a process flow for X, you know, and it will produce the visual for you extremely quickly. So it won't be as good as what you do. And obviously it won't be the same as what's in your head getting down on paper. But I was very impressed with A, the speed, and also that you got that instant gratification of having a visual that at least gave you a baseline. Yes. Yep. So with the text-based stuff like your ChatGPTs and your Claudes or whatever, you can get a quick text baseline. Yeah. So if you're writing content or, you know, writing process documentation, it gives you that starting point and you're away, right? That's sometimes the biggest challenge, isn't it? Starting. Yeah. You mentioned the blank page. Yeah. Yeah. You know, whether it's a drawing or a document, a Google Doc. You know, the difficult piece is starting the writing. But if you can get it started, and I find sometimes that I'll have AI write something for me, I'll completely ignore what it wrote for me, but it's given me that kickstart.
Enough.
I've seen some words on a page and it's given me the inspiration to continue, even though I've used nothing of what it's generated for me. Yeah. And I feel a little bit like that with Jedda AI. So I definitely have a chat about it. I want to get the dude that runs it on the podcast, because we're connected on LinkedIn and we were due to have a bit of a meeting.
Oh, cool.
But that's one of those where I look at it and think, actually, from a, you know, quick visual, let's get a bit of inspiration. I was quite impressed by that. But no, it's obviously not Mike Manilak level of mind mapping collaboration.
It's probably 10 times more in a lot of ways, but I'll have to check it out, because I totally agree with you. Like, I think people kind of, there's always these mini barriers to the next step that slow things down. And I think if you don't have to think about a starting point for, well, how do I visualize that? And then it just pops up. You're kind of already advanced, to your point. The barrier has been removed. Even if it's not exactly what you want, like, it moves you forward. And there's a lot of value to that. And I think that's where most people are using it mainly, myself included, which is kind of like a productivity hack. Mm-hmm. Like you said, the second brain, you said like bouncing ideas off of. I feel like that's where it's helped. Or I could spend, you know, 20 minutes revising this email to make it more concise. Or I can just see an example really quick in 5 seconds what a more concise version would look like. Excuse me. But I feel like that's how most people are using it. The end-to-end thing is really hard. But maybe you don't need the end-to-end to be very powerful and, you know, an incredible advancement. And it's just the individual productivity hack. That's still not bad. You know what I mean? I think maybe the end-to-end is hard to do because there's so many moving pieces, even for something simple. You would have to write prompt after prompt, and even if there's something that can generate the prompt, does it know all the different details? And I think that's sort of where you always hear the output's only as good as the person who can review the output to see that it looks right, because AI is always 100% confident, and it could be completely false, but it sounds so damn confident that it makes you feel like it's gold as an answer. So I don't know. I feel like I'm curious to see how far we can take even just these productivity hacks on an individual level, because I think you can take it pretty far.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't have been able to do what I do and have great conversations like this unless the tech was supporting me to be efficient in what I did. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because, you know, nobody's got an easy job. You know, jobs take time. People quite often work overtime. You know, especially if they want, you know, they want to get promoted and all that sort of, maybe we have you on again, because I know your book is entirely about, you know, acing your interviews and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, no flux given, definitely check it out. But it's one of those where if I didn't have a decent set of tools that in reality I pay peanuts for, mm-hmm. I wouldn't be able to produce any of this stuff. We wouldn't be here without the tech, essentially, is the short way of saying that, right? So, yeah. You know, I think it's all valid points. It's all really valid points. So, Mike, do you want to tell people where they can find out more about you? And then I'll drop it all in the show notes and we can wrap up there, because I appreciate it's the middle of the day for you. So you probably need to get back to work.
It's been fun chatting. You can find me on LinkedIn, Mike Manilak. I put out a lot of stuff there. But also check out my website, mikefromaccounting.com. It's geared towards mostly accountants that are maybe feeling stuck or feel like the opportunities that have presented themselves aren't really what they would really hope for. Maybe they're unfulfilled in some way. So I try to show the fun and fulfilling side of accounting and talk a little bit about that here, but the website's really based around that. So I have a lot of the articles I've written and illustrate them all myself. So they're kind of fun, but yet informative too. And then I've got that course about, virtual collaboration and how to sort of be a leader in that space. It's called Sketchy Business Practices, where I get sketchy on a digital whiteboard. So check that out. And then the playbook, which I called No Flux Given. And that's how to land the accounting job of your dreams. And essentially that came about me interviewing back and forth across Silicon Valley at some top companies like your Facebooks or Amazon or Nike, Salesforce, Uber, Tesla, Twitter, companies like that. And failing a lot, but then finally like getting a successful formula that I wanted to share out for anybody else that has a dream job in the accounting space that maybe is probably very high competition to get that. And if anybody's looking for the edge on how they might want to approach that, check out that playbook, No Flux Given. Shoot me a note. Any of your listeners, if you want to chat, connect with me. I'm pretty accessible, but would love to come back and chat about more of this stuff, AI or creativity side of things. I feel like you've got a lot of good topics going on these days. So happy to come back, and I'll be looking forward to the future episodes with, the Jetta AI guy. You got to get him on.
Got to get him on. Yeah. And yeah. I mean, we've been recording for an hour and 15 now, and it feels like 5 minutes. So
it's been fun. Be back
on, Mike. But no, absolute pleasure. I'll put it all in the show notes. So yeah, mikefromaccounting.com. Check him out there. Connect on LinkedIn. But no, it's been a pleasure, Mike. Really appreciate you coming on.
Awesome. Thank you.
Hey again, and thanks for listening. If you enjoyed what you heard today, don't forget to like, review, and subscribe. And for more goodies, head over to techforfinance.com. See you soon.